Hello and welcome to the Sid Warrior podcast. Thank you so much for joining in. Today we have Varun with us. We are going to talk a lot about entrepreneurship, startups. I want to ask him about productivity and a little bit about NFTs. So thank you for joining in. Varun, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to this one.
Varun, where are you speaking from?
Bombay.
Oh, okay. Excellent. We're sharing the city. Where are you in
Yes.
Bombay?
I live in what I was initially told is where I will never leave, which is Lokhandwala and Andheri, because I started off with the whole media space and kind of have continued to be a part of it somewhere or the other. And here, if you throw a stone, you find five production houses and
Sure.
10 casting rooms and everything else.
And it'll bounce off a dozen models.
No, 100%. Yeah, every single coffee shop at least, and I've heard it's kind of back exactly the way it has been. Although now all the coffee shops are weirdly only a Starbucks. Everything else seems to have disappeared. I only find Starbucks everywhere now.
Yeah. Maybe it's just a giant conspiracy.
It definitely is. Yeah. The conspiracy to change all the coffee shops and to put it all under Starbucks is the
Yeah.
core thing there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the plan behind the whole pandemic. Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, I used to actually sit in some of those, and in full disclosure, would and listen in on some of the chats around, find them very amusing sometimes. While I was waiting for the people, not just for that reason. That is not the only reason why I was in those coffee shops, but
Sure.
it was one of the most amusing parts of sitting at one.
Yeah,
How
that
about you?
makes
Where
it.
about are you?
I'm in Borivali. So I practice, I have my own practice in Borivali and further north, so towards Nalasopara. That's where I grew up in, actually. I grew up in Nalasopara. My father has a hospital there.
Oh, nice.
So thrice a week I would go there and thrice a week I would practice in Borivali.
I come from a family of doctors, so I
Oh,
whenever I
really?
meet someone, my entire family's like a multi-specialty hospital. My dad's a general surgeon. My grandfather was a physician. My grandmother was a gynecologist.
Wow.
I have a orthopedic surgeon in the family, bunch of gynecologists, ENT, dentist. I think pretty much all taken care of. Like
So,
somebody has something across the family. I
right.
chose to go in the other direction.
Well, somebody had to.
Yeah, for sure. There were too many of us otherwise.
I recently had put out a tweet about how doctors should really step out of their hospitals once in a while.
Oh man,
Because
so
it's such a
true.
closed community and you don't even understand what is going on around. The last 2 days I spent with about 200 neurologists at a conference. And after a long time, if I may add, that I'm meeting so many doctors at once. And I realized the difference in conversation between doctors and content creators.
Oh, for sure. I also feel it's interesting to say that. I feel it's also a bit of a bubble, because you're just doing that day in and day out, and you have like no, like I remember initially when I decided to kind of work in the like, so first I was doing engineering, which is understandable. We kind of got that. But when I started to work for like television and do media and then start an agency, all that, half the time for me to have to explain, I realized that because everything kind of comes down to okay, patients and cases and that's, I mean, I guess also that's the focus, right? That's what that becomes life.
It does. And once you are in it, you feel that since nothing else outside of it is really affecting me, I don't need to look into all of that. Which is kind of the opposite when you are an entrepreneur, I suppose, or when you're an investor, because I think everything will affect you.
I think also, so I think there are a few careers which do survive well in a bubble. I think in some ways, the medical field is one. But I feel what's different now, at least from what I've said, and I think my conversations have now evolved to how technology is becoming a core part of it. How do you put your content across? I actually, and this is a fact, I was one of the first people to sit with my dad and explain how to edit video. Because he would do conferences, and he used to do a lot of laparoscopic surgery and still does. So he would record those, and he would have them on tapes, and he'd convert them onto like CDs and stuff like that. And he'd sit and trying to edit them. So I sit with him and try and figure that one out. So, and now actually talking a lot more about the tech aspect of things. I think the overlap there now foundationally has become content and tech. But especially like you're right, to be an entrepreneur, you need to honestly be a massive generalist in many cases, because you need to handle things that you didn't really want to. Like I didn't realize I would have to handle finance for so many years, or When people said operations, it also meant the fact that you have to figure out if the loo isn't working, what to do there. And
it's just a fancy term.
Yeah, it's a fancy term, operations. But no, basically, you're the guy who people call and say, okay, the loo's not working, what are you supposed to do? Right? And stuff like that. Or like, or the roof is leaking, well, it's monsoon rains in Bombay. Wow. So we're trying to figure that bucket to kind of take care of that leak there. So that, as glamorized as operations sounds, that actually comes down to the core of it. You're just plugging all the leaks.
You completely ruined the term for me for chief of operations. So next time somebody introduces themselves, imagine them with a bucket running around.
I actually called myself a janitor for the longest time. People would say, what do you do? And I'm like, I have a fancy designation, but I'm basically the janitor. I help clean stuff up. Because that is honestly an entrepreneur's job. Your job is to, like, you know, you have a set of people who are doing a lot of work. You are there to make sure that anything that goes sideways, you're kind of coming in to kind of help out. That's how I always see it. And that's what actually makes it makes it a lot of fun as well, because it's so dynamic. I have a problem with focusing on things, so this helps.
That's really interesting, because people have a similar viewpoint about doctors, because when kids say that I want to be a doctor, they look at the final product. They look at some doctors that they've seen growing up, but nobody really prepares them for residency.
Yeah.
It's not possible. Nothing can prepare you for residency. And by the time you realize it's too late, you are already on your third night shift. You haven't slept for 72 hours. There are people threatening to hit you, and congratulations, you're on your way to being a doctor.
Yeah, I've had a few cousins who've done that. I know my dad's obviously told me many stories over the years.
Yeah.
My dad, my uncle, etc. But I've had a few cousins who also became doctors. So I've heard from them. Yeah. And I'd go visit my first cousin when she was studying in Manipal, and she'd tell me about this. I'm like, I think I made the right call. I'm, like, I'm okay. Because I think that's actually how it's interesting to say night shift. So me deciding not to be a doctor was based on, apart from the fact that I wasn't really interested, was and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So my dad asked me a simple question, said, you know, if you're out with a bunch of friends till 1 in the night and go to sleep, someone wakes you up at 3:30 and says, go save someone's life, what's your first instinct? I said, I'm like, can somebody else do this right now? Because I just slept 1.5 hours ago. He's like, you will not be a doctor. I think that was the most sound advice I have ever heard. But it's a fact.
That's a pretty great line that you can't cross. Yeah, that's a great interview line. In fact, all students should go through that questioning.
Yeah,
because it's not just about the glamour of what you see on television shows. Yeah. You know, that you just emergency patient wheeled in and you just saved their life.
Yeah,
there's a lot more to it.
Depends on what you're watching, though. If you're watching Grey's Anatomy, etc., that's one side. If you're watching old Mithun movies, that's a whole different. Your expectations are in the wrong place.
Sure. I mean, brain, if you expect that brain transplant, or if you can diagnose pregnancy by just touching somebody's hand, that is not going to happen.
Although I used to be fascinated by the red bulb. As a kid, I've actually gone and seen surgery. I don't know if we were allowed to, but at that point of time, nobody really cared. Our family had a nursing home. So I would walk down, wear the mask, put on the cap, and basically put on the robe. And they'd got one small one made for me. Because I think all doctors said, you know, can get their kids to experience it. Yeah. And I would kind of go in and I was always fascinated when I saw the red bulb on outside. And I was like, well, it's an actual thing. The red bulb does come on. Yeah, so
it's the primitive way of saying surgery going on, do not disturb.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
What's your entrepreneurship journey been like? What got you onto this road?
I became an entrepreneur by mistake, if that's the way to put it. I feel more oftentimes people kind of go in and say, okay, no, I decided to be an entrepreneur. I had a business plan. I had a great insight and I built it out. And that's one entire category of entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
I was a category who was like, okay, I have a job, and I was working at Channel V at that point of time. I had directed, produced reality TV shows for about three, four years. And I had and done some of the largest shows they had. I'd already kind of produced all of that. And I gotten that chance because when suddenly senior people leave to take up other opportunities and there's a gap. And before they could hire somebody, you ask the junior worker, do you want to do this? And I said, yes. And a few others said yes. And so we got that bump up. And so, I'd done a bunch of those things, but the TV space was changing. It was going away from the fun, cool, you know, reality TV or like music channel vibe and going more like general entertainment. And me and Rohit, who apart from being my best friend, roommate, also worked at Chandler at that point of time, and both of us kind of sat down, and he was like, I think I'm just going to go out and see if I can direct outside and see what we can do. Maybe some fun stuff's happening online as well. The digital thing was just kind of starting off.
This is 2009. When was this? Okay.
2009, yeah. So very like a year after recession. We could hear rumblings or something happening online. We didn't really know what that was. Facebook was still a thing.
Yeah.
I'm told it still is. I still go there often enough. But it was still very early days in the digital space. Right? There was no actual video content. There was no term called creator, nothing like that. So we got out and said, okay, we've been doing some fun stuff with brands on the shows and the promos we're producing. Let's go and try and do that. And I knew how to produce because I used to handle a lot of logistics apart from just like direction, etc. on shows. And Rohit was directing a bunch of promos and ads for Channel V.
Right.
So we said, okay, the two of us, we live out of the same apartment. Let's just calculate how much money you might need every month. Let's take this jump. If we don't do this now, when will we? Because we didn't have responsibilities, right? We didn't have to pay for family, none of that stuff. Just we had to pay for our rent. Bread and bed, rather, is what we had to pay for.
Yeah.
And hopefully beer at some point of time was the idea. We overestimated how much money we had, because by the time we quit and we actually got our first project, we realized that we didn't actually have money for 3 months. We had money for a month. And we said, okay, what we'll do is that if we don't keep getting work, we'll take it every 2 months and we'll just quit, maybe go look for a job.
Yeah.
And that's how we became entrepreneurs, because we just had to register a company. And I still remember this, my CA had called me and said, okay, you need to get service tax registered. I had no idea what service tax was. I'm like, okay. But he said, do you think you'll make 12 lakhs in the first year? I'm like, 12 lakhs simply is like a lot of money. I don't think I'm going to make all that money. So it's fine. I might not need it. He said, just for backup, I'll register and keep it. You decide if you want to use it or not.
Right.
And thank God it did, because we actually made a lot. It is business-wise, did a lot more than that. And in hindsight, that was not that much money between the two of us, because it wasn't equivalent to our salaries together at that point of time, but still it was like, we still had expenses to do. We knew nothing. We just went out there and decided to wing it.
Yeah.
But that's how we became entrepreneurs. And I feel that somewhere along the way, we had someone kind of apply and said, can I intern with you guys? You seem to be doing some fun work. We were doing a lot of shoots. We were doing anything which came our way, to be honest. And I think that really helped to kind of go in by mistake helps, because you're picking up stuff for two reasons. To sustain the business, just basically get money in the bank.
Yeah.
And to still try and do the stuff you find fun to do or interesting to do. And we just kept doing that. We didn't really go in with a set plan. And that really helped. That kind of helped us in the first, I would say, two, three years. Because we just kept picking up stuff.
Does that also make you more adaptable? Not having a fixed plan.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And more than adaptable, I think at some point we just sat down and said, okay, what is the stuff we would love to do? And what is the stuff we're okay to do for money? And okay to for money meant that we were making promos for like Disney DVDs that would come on Disney Channel. We would make logos of people for a couple of grand. We would make AVs for sales conferences. We made a show deal for a bunch of actors who wanted to go to Hollywood. By just literally gave us all their DVDs. We would run through those movies, cut out the scenes and create a sequence.
Yeah.
We did all that stuff. Right. And that wasn't necessarily fun, but it was okay. We could do it.
So,
but then we also went and pitched like an interactive video, and we would go pitch can we add tech into a content piece? And we would, say, okay, the movie's kind of coming out. We can do this around a movie, which will just be a bit of a gimmick and we could
generate buzz and all.
Yeah. And all that stuff. So we kept pushing those things. And that's what we really wanted to do. And so over time, what really helped was the fact that became our, why people came to us. And these guys come up with really interesting things you could do. Sometimes you'd pitch stuff which we didn't know how to do. It seemed like a fun idea. And then we're like, how are we going to do this? Like, I still remember we had pitched a 3D AV, I think in the early years, where basically you could sit with 3D glasses and the entire AV in a sales conference would come at you. And this wasn't like Avatar 3D, right? This was like Chota Chetan. If anybody understands that reference, this is the oldest 3D movie, which was the blue and red glasses, right? And we said we can make it, and that we had to make that AV in 10 days, and we had no idea. So then somebody in the office kind of just like Googled it, and we found some tutorials and we made something out. And then you had to figure out where you're going to get those glasses. And the conference had so many, like hundreds of people. Eventually it worked and the client was happy. We did a bunch of those. We did those for a lot of clients. And that's when we realized, okay, sometimes some gimmicks work for different audiences. And then we would replicate that and try to think of the next gimmick. And that's how we actually became known for like, really like bizarre ideas which nobody really thought was possible, and we said maybe we'll try.
What was your production house called? The first name?
So we ended up calling it The Glitch when we started off, but right. when we wanted to make the company, we actually decided to, we were going to call it Jay Veeru and Company, because we had a photograph, me and Rohit, on that bike from Sholay,
sure.
which we did on a shoot. In hindsight, thank God we chose otherwise, but yeah, so we were always called The Glitch. We actually spent 6 months thinking of the name and 1 month trying to figure out what we'll do.
Yeah.
Not the best use of time.
This is a question that I often wonder for new startups or new entrepreneurs, that do you go in with a line that you won't cross, or certain projects that you won't take, or certain brands that you won't collaborate, depending on, you know, your own identity or your own brand's identity? Do you think that is a sensible thing? Do you think that is something that's sustainable?
I think you put that into two categories, right? One category is that, what do you think you can't do, even if you wanted to? Like, and this goes to even till date, Glitch has never done a campaign for a political party or anything like that. Because I think inherently, as a team and as people, we could do a good job at it, even if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't think that's something which we can actually do well, and I don't think we really want to. As I think so, that's one kind. It's like, you know, you can't do a good job at it, and then that's fine. Right. The other kind is, I don't want to do stuff that is. And sometimes we tried, we actually tried. So I remember that we had briefly had a client who was opening up India's first sex store, like basically, like, you know, everything around sex, like from lubricants, toys, everything else.
Yeah.
Well, he came into with, we said, okay, this is a great category that's going to get disrupted. So we'd love to work with you. But as it started veering towards a zone which you felt uncomfortable with, we said, maybe not. So we've drawn our line there. We've drawn a line about, okay, is this something we're comfortable doing? Would we even do this otherwise? Or would we be okay to put it out there? And that's really been the gauge. But you also look at some categories and say, I don't want to work. Like for us, it was, I think the politics and the and that side of it was very clearly the fact that we just didn't feel we should.
Yeah.
And I think that hasn't changed till now.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a term that I came across when I was reading up about you, which is unhustle. What is that about?
So something which I think about a lot, and it's actually evolved in my head over time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a problem with the word hustle, and the problem with the word hustle is it's a great word. Like, I've hustled to get where I have, very honest. But now it's become a bit of a catchphrase, right? We need to talk. For me, unhustling is basically you're priming yourself for happiness and performance versus not just like kind of getting ahead, because you can only this whole like faking it till you make it scenario is the worries. Because if you are performing at your highest level of performance and yet you're also kind of making sure you are happy doing it, that's a better spot to be in than saying, okay, I will wing it as long as I can and eventually I'll get somewhere.
Yeah.
Winging it will only get you so far. And I feel that most time hustling is, and it's unfortunate, hustling is actually, it's given so many of us great careers and great these things, but it's not become a catchphrase. It's become a way for you to say, okay, I'll just like, I'll claim to be something maybe which I'm not, or I will make unhealthy choices for myself and my life. So at some point, that term is the term I started using. I have been called out on it and I've explained myself, which is why over time I've actually even stopped saying unhustle a little bit. I say high performance a little bit more. That seems to sound better. But I think my issue with hustling is just that, is that it's not about the term, it's about how we're using it. And we're also abusing it, right? You know, I haven't slept all night. I haven't slept more than 4 hours in like a week. It's not a badge of honor. You are going to crash. I was listening to Matthew Walker on a podcast, and he was saying that, you know, how people say that I'll sleep and I'm dead. You keep saying that, you will actually die, which I think is a fact, right? And I'll come to value health a lot more. I feel if you're healthier, if you are happier with some of the choices in your life, you'll still be able to hustle and yet be able to be happy. You don't have to compromise. I think that's really where I was coming from. It's an evolving thought in my head, and it often comes out in different ways.
Yeah, because the term, the positives of hustling is opportunism, the idea to, or the ability to pick up on when can you move in, when can you say yes, when can you understand that I'll say yes now and I will learn it. Just like you gave the example of the 3D
exactly,
baby,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
That is a hustle and there is so much positive out of it.
Yeah.
But what you said about health, I believe that if you are sensible, you will know that to hustle well, you need to be healthy.
Exactly.
So you're not really playing the long game if you're skipping out on sleep, saying that you'll study or work harder then.
I was talking to someone the other day and I was telling them that when I was interning, I would be in the office for 10 days in a row, right? I would, because MTV at that time, I interned and worked at MTV before I moved to Channel V, and they'd have a shower. They'd have, I had a sleeping bag. I had a change of clothes. So I would just not leave. And I was one day asked to go home. And they said, you cannot just be here. Go get a life. You know, and it happened because I was sitting on the editing table. And actually, I don't think I've spoken about this before. You know, you have your hand on the mouse and you're editing for a while and you're going to sleep and you're getting up and you're editing and sleeping. My arm froze up because it was on that mouse for so long. So at some point, I couldn't move. So I was using my other hand.
Oh,
and then someone
God.
Walked in and said, what are you doing? You don't have to like... And because I was trying to get stuff done faster than anybody else. Okay, if somebody can do an edit in like a day, I will do it in half a day. You know, I will do more and more and more. And at some point, it's not worth it. And I was thankful at that point in time. You know, and still try to remember who said that to me. And it was one of the people I reported into. And he said, okay, just go home. Take the weekend. Give your arm some rest. You'll come back and you'll do a better job at your edit, which you're struggling with right now. Because I was struggling. I was struggling getting an edit right because I used to eliminate, I used to do the elimination rounds. So you want to have high drama, do the music, do all that stuff. So, and that I think was invaluable because even over the years, I've actually realized that I'm happier at times when I decide to sleep for a certain number of hours every day.
Right.
Don't, it is all like, you know, go hard, party hard, all those things which we do. And maybe it's because I've gotten older. I'm almost hitting 40 now. So maybe it's because I'm older, maybe because I have a kid, but I just generally feel that it's an unhealthy notion to connect all of these to you being successful.
Productive. Yeah.
But it's actually not.
There is also, I'm a little conflicted by this because while I am completely on the side of maintaining good health, I also believe that there has to be one phase in your life where you do push yourself a little bit outside of your comfort zone just to figure out till where can you go. And from the perspective of medicine and doctors, I feel like I would never feel overworked again because of those 3 years that I spent at KEM hospital. It is not possible. I cannot feel overworked ever again. And that is a good thing, ironic as it may sound. And I'm completely empathetic of all the students who are out there who are going through it right now. But I'm just sharing my lived experience that as much as I hated it then, it just sets the groundwork, right? Like, you know what you're capable of now.
Yeah, I if I look at my, when I mentioned I worked for about 3-4 years before we started Glitch, those 3-4 years, I worked so much, right? I was living my job. I didn't really do anything else, but... And I agree that that is invaluable, but you need to know when to hit that switch. I'll give you an example of the switch, right? I used to smoke. I was a regular smoker, do 10, 15 cigarettes a day. Did that for the longest time. Also, you're on a shoot. You have a, you know, when you take a break, you're having a cigarette, having a nice sugary cup of chai. and that standard, that's what you're surviving on, and vada pav.
Sure.
There was a point, I think in my last year in Channel V, when I was doing a show which required me and our kid, and because it was a reality show and we were also running with cameras and not the camera people and the contestants and the people are running across the city, there was a lot happening.
Right.
It required me to be active. And I was heaving and panting. Right. I was going from like, and I was like, at my age, I shouldn't be. I was still a little more active than some of the others. There were other people also, everybody was heaving and panting. That's a different point because all of us were unhealthy in our lifestyle, right? But I quit. One of the core things that pushed me to quit smoking was that. I'm like, if I can't do what I really love to do, like even today, I look back with total fondness at my reality TV time because it was so much fun to do. Like, I think I have learned so much about just people managing stress, managing just like surviving through periods of time during those 3-4 years. But when you start feeling, okay, all these things I'm pushing myself for, because you would have a cigarette because you want to think. So I thought was, okay, if I have a smoke, it's helping me think. It's helping me take that break. Yeah. But it became something that was holding me back from performing the way I wanted to at what I was doing. And I think that's the line. When you feel it, you need to stop. But oftentimes we don't feel it and we push ourselves further. And that's when it actually becomes yeah. worse. So I agree with you 100% that experience is so important.
Yeah.
But we don't have to push ourselves beyond what yeah. is affecting us in negative form.
I think I can add one corollary to this. That as important as it is to find out till where you can push yourself, it's also important to find out what kind of breaks do you need and how to identify when you need those breaks. So during those residency periods, I remember working extra hard a couple of hours so that I can get a couple of hours off.
Yeah.
Because within that chaos, those 2 hours would seem so valuable. Even if I don't do anything, even if I'm just going out for a cup of coffee or playing my Xbox for 2 hours, that's still okay. It's just my island of mental peace. So how to find out those small bubbles of sanity within that chaotic space is an art form, I feel. And everybody should learn that.
Yeah, and also learn it in a way that, and this is more a recent discovery. I don't think I would have followed it if I was younger. Is that your breaks should not also involve things that tie you out more. I love working out, right? It's become last two, three years become strong. I feel that helps me. It doesn't tire me out. It energizes me.
Yeah.
But if I want to relax and I just sit and have too many drinks, I know I'm going to wake up the next day just feeling really terrible, and that doesn't help the next day, doesn't help that day also. So you limit that out. Same goes for I love my food. But if you're overdoing it so much that you're going to be so lethargic, then again, it's just some of those things. And you need to find the best ways to tune out. I do this thing with my exercise with my daughter. She loves it. She's 4. I sometimes make her lie down on the bed next to me and look at the fan, and we try to imagine what that could be. Right. It's a great, you're not looking at a screen. It's a great activity to do. It helps you kind of tune into your imagination. It's really random, but it's a lot of fun to do. So I always enjoy doing this even as a kid, that I would look at things and imagine what they could be. And you take me on to ceiling, kind of imagine Transformers running over it. So I'm one of those people.
Oh, yes. So me and my brother, during our summer vacations, we would go to Kerala. So we have our ancestral house there. And for us, it's the closest thing we've gotten to Narnia.
Yeah.
Because you're in a house which is surrounded by trees and there's nobody else around, and you're already reading Enid Blyton and you're imagining imagining magic trees that can take you to different places, and you're completely in your own world. And now, after reading about neuroscience, I realize how important that is for children to develop that aspect of their brain, which is creative thinking and imagination and child's play. If all your input is coming from the screen, you are left with very little to do.
It's that whole prefrontal frontal cortex piece, right?
Absolutely.
Which I think if all of us read a little bit too much about it these days than ever, but yeah.
Absolutely. So that's also the difference between reading books and watching TV.
Yeah.
The TV leaves nothing to the imagination. You have to do zero work.
Which is why I like podcasts, though. I think podcasts let you think a lot more.
Yeah. It gives you more space. It doesn't insist, this is the only reality that you shall follow. You still have space to make what you want from it.
Yeah. It's actually been a method. It's interesting me saying this, right? Because I sometimes think about the methods I kind of used over the years to, so as a kid, I'd go on top of the terrace. We live in an older house in a small town. So you have those, those tile roofs. I'd all imagine that's a mountain. You can conquer it and do all that stuff. But even when I was working at an MTV, for instance, I've been in the office many days, go out for a break, I'd put my headphones on, listen to some music, and I would just walk. And I would walk with no sense of where I was going, and I would just go in random directions, right? And it wasn't like I was on something, just for clarity. I was just generally I just got out, listen to music, just walk. And eventually you reach some point, maybe I should turn back now. But that itself was great because I was just I don't think I was tuned out from the world. I was walking around, so I had some form of awareness, but it would just help me think. And I do some of these kind of things. I feel that over the years, and when I was younger, even now, which has really helped me kind of sit down and not like, and for me, it's a struggle to not want to consume something as content. It's a constant struggle. My screen time is too high, as I'm guessing for most people. But there's something very freeing, just kind of sitting around and not having something to look at.
One of the biggest challenges that I'm facing is I want to go for a run without my headphones for once. And I'm finding myself unable to do it. I feel like it's lost time. I feel like, how can I not be listening to a podcast or music or anything? It has come to the point where it doesn't matter what is entering my brain as long as something is. And I'm trying to get away from it.
I had heard this. I'm trying to remember. So there's a podcast by Rich Roll, which I listened to, called the Rich Roll podcast, right? There was a guest, and I forget his name, and he'd done a documentary on hunter-gatherers. And I think the tribe's called the Mahawi tribe, if I remember correctly. I don't fully recollect. And he said that for them, running is a spiritual experience. And so when they run, they're not putting on like an Apple Watch or putting on headphones and checking the route.
I feel attacked.
They said, we run in the morning to welcome mother sun, and our feet are touching father earth, or something like that, if I remember correctly. Right? And it's so beautiful when you even say that, is that, so I actually tried this some time back. I would normally, there's a running-ish track on top of our building. They basically, someone realized in Bombay, you can't make running tracks anywhere. So they decided to like connect three blocks of our apartment building and make a running track on top.
Beautiful.
So I was running there, and honestly, from there, from far away, you can actually see the sea on one end, and you can see the city on the other end. And the sea is far away, but you can still see it. And I would normally just like have my head down, because I'd be listening to something and I would run, and I would never notice it. So I remember listening to this episode, and I said, okay, let me leave my phone at home once. I still wore my watch, because I want to just like, not track calories somewhere in my head. But I ran and actually just kept looking out.
Yeah.
Experience itself was so much more beautiful, because I kind of went in saying, I'm not looking at anything. I'm looking at the sea. I'm looking at the sky. I noticed birds. I noticed, in the middle of a concrete jungle, you somehow notice things which you never really noticed, even though they've always been there. And so there's something to this, I think, mother, son, and father earth business.
I've read about this, I think it was Japanese technique of martial art training, where they would tie 5-10 kgs to your feet and then make you practice all your training exercises. So you're kicking, you're running, you're jumping, everything, but with 5 or 10 kgs to your feet. So that in the end, when you remove it, you will find yourself stronger than you ever were before.
So true.
Now, what is happening with our brain is that we are actually creating the ability to have more and more attention. But all of that attention is being pinned down to social media, Netflix, podcast, email, messenger, something. My theory is that if you can somehow let go of these weights, you may actually find yourself more productive and having more attention span than ever before, but you have to do it. You have to let go of these weights in some way.
I think your theory is very sound. I'll give you an example. When you're saying this, I remembered one thing, is that 4 years ago, and now I tell people, I never told people, 4 years ago, I switched off notifications for email on my phone. No one's complained. Once in a while, I'll get a message saying, you know, can you reply on that email? Which anyway, I think most times I would have end up missing, because you get like, get CC'd onto some 50 things every day anyway, which don't really concern you. You just need to be FYI. You need to know this. Because what would happen is every time a phone would ping, I'd pick up my phone. So I one day sat, I took off notifications of every single news app, notifications across social media. The only thing I have, I think, is WhatsApp. And it stays that way till date. It has freed me in such an amazing way that I still go to my phone often enough, but I'm going out of my own will. I'm not going because someone's poking me all the time to look at it. And on the other end, I feel that it's this whole freeing. We said I tried to journal for years. And I couldn't, because I would try an app, and I don't want to do these things on the phone. I would try to read books only off the Kindle. And somewhere, I think in the last year, I've actually started to say, like, let me just go back to old school ways of doing this, right? So
buy a book.
Start journaling on a notebook. buy a physical book. I still read off the Kindle though. I still like constantly read off the Kindle, but just to kind of go back to, you realize the difference about how you consume a book, about how you, you know, just write something down physically versus,
absolutely.
I also inherited as family of doctors, terrible handwriting has been genetically passed on to me. So nobody can read what I write half the time. But it's a journal. So
that's
I write great. In that.
That's
but
nature's way of encrypting.
Yeah. Terrible handwriting runs in the family. My grandmom, though, weirdly enough, is the only doctor I've ever met who actually had amazing handwriting, which I've always said, okay, she breaks the norm of bad handwriting.
No, but she belongs to a generation that really valued such things.
Mm.
There were, and doctors at that generation were rare, especially female doctors.
Mm.
So there is a lot of emphasis.
Yeah, she was the only woman in her batch. I think she was the only woman in her batch, if I remember right.
Yeah. So there's an emphasis on certain things which nowadays are not really important.
I can't read anything which my father writes. I always joke saying, I don't have no idea what he wrote there. But
there's but a...
Sorry. No, no, you think about just like disconnecting from this, right? I think it's that is that as much as digital is convenient, there are some things there's a beauty to analog in that it frees you in so many ways.
Oh yeah. When I started making notes earlier, it was all pen and paper. And then I discovered the iPad and the Apple Pencil and then I made a complete switch. Complete. There was
nothing
on my notebook. Since the last 2 years though, I switched to an ink pen, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is ink.
I tried that for a while.
Yeah. So it was just a meditative thing that in the morning you wake up, you feel ink. So you feel like, okay, your day is starting. You can go to work now.
Yeah.
And I've realized that when I'm having a conversation, so even now when you're talking to me, when I think of a random thing, I just jot it down.
Yeah.
I don't feel that same feedback when I'm jotting it down on my iPad versus on a piece of paper with an ink pen.
No.
So I'm not going to fight it anymore. It is what it is. If it feels better, just go for it.
So I have not given. So my thing is I do a mixture of both. I have like 4 notebooks. I have this bunch of stacks of paper. I still write on the iPad. So my problem is I write notes in too many places, but I agree with you. It's just, I think also psychologically, we're all kind of going back to, and I don't know if it's the last 2 years and just generally having way too much screen time.
Yeah.
But just kind of going back to things which were you kind of took for granted, right? And I think took for granted in that sense. Like this, the mic I'm recording on has actually like, I'm going to pick it up for a second because I actually started doing this in books, right? You just put those bookmarks on the side. So you highlight and then you do those small tabs to kind of go. And it's, and I find the experience of even putting these small things over there to tag where, where I've highlighted something is, there is something beautiful about it. And I have friends around who kind of put me back onto not being deeply philosophical and saying, you're just getting old. You like these old people things now. And I'm like, not old, but okay, fair enough. I'll give
you. No, there's more than that. I'll tell you, I'll give you a word to throw back at them.
Mm.
There's a phenomenon happening called social derealization, which is as we go more and more digital, we start questioning reality more and more.
Lovely.
What is real?
Mm.
Are the friends that you have on social media real? Are the followers that you have real? Are the likes real? Are you more liked because you have more likes? Do you have more friends because you have more friends on Facebook? And slowly we start circling all the way back to how is any of this connected to me? Am I happier? When my digital persona is happier, am I happier? And then who am I? If I'm not this person that people see on Instagram, then who am I? So then this getting back to physical books and pen and paper is almost like a desperate attempt to cling on to something that is grounded in the world that we see around us.
I'm actually going to steal this term from you. I'm like, this is, I like to kind of have, this is me trying to reach for a notebook right now. I always have this stack of papers lying around. So there's always something there to scribble on. Social derealization. It makes so much sense when you're saying it, right? I was watching the Matrix trailer, the new one, and I was like, this is like, we're living them in the Matrix. You just don't realize that this is the Matrix. We're living on social media. We're living on this, but when you actually meet a group of friends physically and you hang out, you know the difference. You're not waiting to see who's liked what you said. You're just letting, you're making fun of each other. You're just having a good time. I feel as much as we might try to digitize how we function, innately as humans, we just need other humans.
Right. In fact, the irony is that we are still living in the hunter-gatherer time in our brain. Forget about the digital age. Our brains haven't even evolved to the technological age or the steam engine age. Mm. We are still living in the jungle.
Yeah.
We are still foraging for food. We are still concerned about whether our tribe will throw us out or not. Yeah. That is still the core functionality. Now, add on top of this Instagram and Twitter, and we are literally feeling stretched through time. Because a part of our brain is in the jungle and a part of our brain is in cryptocurrency. Who the hell are we?
And that's actually an interesting point, right? When I feel that, which is why modes like, the other day I sat down and I do this every 3 months. I sat down and say, am I enjoying what I'm doing right now? Beyond work. Because work involves a lot of stuff which you have to do. But if I decided to be a creator because I like being a creator. It has a lot of perks, but it's still at some point when it starts to feel like work, when you suddenly feel like you're doing something for the sake of doing it, when you kind of fall into that trap, kind of sit back and say, why am I doing this, right? And I sat back and realized that I really enjoy creating a certain kind of content. And I'm not as bothered about how many people consume it as long as some people do. So I actually sat and reset expectations. So I was going to this, okay, how many views has a reel got or how many listens has an episode of my podcast got? I was going down that loop and I kind of hit pause over there. And I said, no, see how many people respond to you with actual value. Just kind of look at, is that giving you something back? So I get that value from my newsletter, for instance. Right? People actually write back clear points, opinions on what I kind of put out there. Sometimes on a podcast episode, someone will write into something, I love what you put out there, or like, you know, this kind of made sense. And I think I think often enough, we have to reset our mind because the world pushes us in a certain direction. Yeah. And we have to just kind of go back to saying, 1 second, don't fall into the trap. There is so much good with what social media can do for you. Just don't fall into the trap of like just doing what you feel it needs you to do rather than just doing what you actually feel like doing.
Yeah, it's such a spiral, isn't it?
Mm.
If you lose balance, you could just go on circling downwards.
Oh, so bad. It's such a spiral also because it's so easy to just do what you feel will work rather than, and which might not innately be you, right? Which is what I worry about some creators. I sometimes turn to some creators saying, I know clickbait is important. Don't become clickbait.
Wow.
Because it's... Think about it. At some point, you might start off by doing something, and at some point, you realize something works. And there was, I think, Matt Diavella put it out recently, or the couple of these creators I follow. And he said that because he fell into the trap of just creating content which just wanted to get a kind of reaction, at some point, he moved away from what he actually set out to do.
Yeah.
He had to stop to kind of come back, and this is what I actually like to do. And creators are going through this. The amount of fatigue. Emma Chamberlain, arguably one of the biggest creators in the world, right? I mean, she's literally built her entire thing around just herself because most of her content is just her. There's nobody else in frame.
Yeah.
She had to take a break and figure it out. And she realized that one of the things she enjoyed the most was editing her own videos.
Mm.
She went back to editing her own videos. She built a team. She'd done all of that stuff. She slowed down some aspects of what she does that she didn't enjoy as much, or which was kind of affecting her mentally. And she just started editing her videos again, made it slower, made it different. Still works, but more importantly, it works for her, right? And she's happy doing it. I think that's sometimes you forget that in trying to game it. And again, I think it all ties back to the hustle part we spoke about earlier, right?
Yeah.
In you trying to hustle, are you optimizing your life for happiness and performance? Yeah. The two things we want, right? We want to perform optimally at what we do, and we want to be happy. As long as you can do both, you can get both in some measure. You're on the right track. You will not have both all times. You will not be happy with everything. But if there's enough of that in a day, I feel somewhere you can kind of put that
happiness,
together.
Happiness is such a tricky thing because
tricky.
it's so relative. If you're happy all the time, would you be aware of it?
No.
It becomes background noise. Yeah.
My question rather is, can you be happy all the time? I don't think inherently humans can be happy all the time.
No, neurochemically speaking, no. You run out of dopamine. Those receptors get saturated. It's not possible.
Yeah. But I think it's a tricky one, right? I feel that if you're happy all the time, you'll get bored.
Yeah.
We need drama in our lives.
Have you heard of this book called The Flow? Or just Flow, not even The Flow, just Flow.
No.
Mihaly, very complicated. I think it's a Polish name. I forget the author. Mm-hmm. But the idea is, when you say that you want to be happy,
yeah,
happiness is a transient state between boredom and frustration.
Mm.
So if you try something, so if you're throwing darts and you hit the bullseye, you're happy.
Yeah.
You hit it you throw a dozen times and you hit it a dozen times, you're happy, but now you're less happy.
Yeah.
And if you hit it 10,000 times, you're bored. What's the point?
Yeah.
And if you don't hit it even once,
you're frustrated.
You're frustrated. So this happiness is that middle ground. You can't really chase it.
Yeah. Which I feel that happiness is almost like tiny moments in the day and not like some overwhelming feeling. Like, you're never going to be overwhelmingly happy all the time. Yeah. There's this...
That's psychosis.
This is a poet called Mary Andrews. She's mm-hmm. I discovered her on Instagram and then I bought her book. She talks about this whole difference between positive thinking and present thinking. She says that don't tell people to be positive. What if I'm not feeling positive today? Right. You can't force me to be positive. I need to feel like what I'm feeling at present. And that's actually more helpful for my headspace than me trying to be positive. Because I think that's the thing, right? Maybe something bad happens or something. If you suddenly get frustrated or you get bored, no, be positive. No, you'll get to happiness. Like, no, feel like what you're feeling right now. You'll move towards it. And it made so much sense.
That's the argument of mindfulness. Mm. Be who you are, where you are. Don't try to be anywhere else.
Yeah.
Are you an early riser?
Now I am. I wasn't for the longest time. I became an early riser because of being a parent.
Mm.
And now I wake up by 6:30. So, but I wasn't. I used to be the person who would wake up late, sleep very late. Standard for the longest time. But I'd say over the last decade, I've slowly veered towards a balance. Like, I still don't sleep early, right? I'll be at 10. Like, some days if I feel really tired, I sleep by 10:30. Sometimes I'll go on till 12, but I'm up between 6:30, 7:30 in the morning. Because in my head, I'm like 7 hours of sleep, 8 hours of sleep. And my dogs don't let me sleep longer than a certain time because they wake me up in the morning for some biscuits and to go to the loo. So
right.
I don't have a choice.
You've outsourced your discipline to kids and pets.
It is amazing. So I have an elderly pet. My older dog is 10,
uh-huh.
right? And he can't, I feel that as you get older, it's like you have to take care of him like he was a puppy, right? So he needs to go early in the morning. So he'll come and scratch. I think I need to go. Then I get up and I let him go and then he's hungry. So I give him a biscuit. So now it's become a ritual. I look forward to that every morning. Like, I know that he's my alarm clock. And sometimes instinctively, I can actually hear his paws because he sleeps in the same room. I can hear his paws on the floor. And that wakes me up before he even comes towards me. Sometimes I woke up. You didn't wake me up today. Do that. But yeah, that's why I became an early riser. But I've really come to enjoy that between 6 a.m. to 7:30 a.m. period. Because 7:30 is when you wake up our daughter to get ready for school and all that stuff. It's still online school book. But I enjoy that part because I just like you just can't get time to yourself. My wife's up because she works out early in the morning. So she's already up and she's gone for a run or something like that. And so it's nice. I think it's a nice silent period of time.
Yeah. I was reading the 5 a.m. club and I mean, a lot of Robin Sharma's books have a lot of repetitive notes, but the basic concept was good that you have actual biological changes when you wake up early, go to sleep early. Definitely something to be encouraged. I always was I never identified as a late riser, but I was a late sleeper because the rising part was just consequence. The main thing was that I wanted the time alone at night.
You want time. That's actually the interesting part, right? Because we just want time alone, which is the reason why you sleep late more than anything else.
Yeah. You want time away from judgment. You want time away from people asking you, why are you doing this? Why aren't you doing this? Just the idea of now this is my time, my space, which is why a lot of people enjoy being awake at night, even if it is study or even if it is to read anything. I think it is almost an identity change when you become an early riser.
Yeah.
It's like you have accepted yourself and you just feel that it doesn't matter now. I can have my own space whenever, wherever.
I think an early riser also means, so I look at, so here's how I look at it, right? I have an hour every night to myself, at least hour and a half. Of course, my wife Pooja and our daughter Leia, they both sleep early. So by they both like passed out by nine most days, 9:30.
Right.
So between that 9 to 10:30, 11 period is my time. I read a book, I you know, watch something. Right now IPL is going on, now I'm watching IPL most nights. But also when I wake up in the morning, because there also is nothing inherent apart from the biscuit giving and the and spending time with the dog, it's again my time. So I think this last year I've had many, I would say I've had about 30% of the time have like woken up in the morning, have at least half an hour to myself, 1 hour to myself in the morning. So morning can be me time. It's just that you need to just figure out where that comes from. I've started to enjoy morning me time a lot more than late night me time. I think you feel a lot fresher. It just feels nicer.
Yeah. And you feel like the day has started with discipline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with a sense of control. I hated those days where I had to rush to work.
Oh.
Because I'm late. Because then everything cascades, you know, from that point on. So you want
to sometimes think about how would we have been if we had to work or maybe even go to college and do all that stuff. If it was online, I think about a lot of them. Like, I'm sure people are just rolling off of bed like 2 minutes before class and coming from another computer, right? Put the camera off and sit in class. And
correct.
Like, what would we have been like? Because I remember missing so many classes. Because I remember there was one professor who would only start class at 7:45 a.m. and 7:46 or there, he would not let you in.
Wow.
So we would never go to his class because we knew we wouldn't wake up. Right. I think I'm just thinking about that. Like, will you almost say a generation of people who don't know how to do that? Like, I wake up at 7:30 and 8 o'clock is when a class starts. Yeah. But because by in half an hour she's taken a bath, she's had a slight snack. How will she react when she actually has to wake up earlier and get onto like a thing and go to school physically? It's going to be a shock for her.
It'll be a torture. She'll feel like she's being punished for something.
For sure.
I had a 1 hour, 45 minute bus drive to school, and school would start at 7.
Oh man!
And so I would be waking up at 5:10, 5:15, and I would like to say that it taught me discipline, but it didn't. It just made me a very angry kid.
Hate it, right? This is. I remember reading somewhere, and I don't know how true it is the fact that actually kids would learn a lot more if school started at 10 a.m.
Yeah.
Because they would actually get this whole like rushing them to that factory outlet system of whatever industrial system of, okay, you need to clock in by 8 a.m. business. And I think Bombay schools anyway are atrociously early.
Correct.
In the way they are. But
they're literally training you to be obedient workers so that you can add to productivity.
And that's actually the change, right? If you look at it, like everything was built around the factory system, like clock in at 8, clock in at 9, clock out at 5.
Yeah.
You need to go somewhere for this, and that whole, like, even how school is structured is that, right? You are sitting and all being trained in the same way.
Think alike, wear alike, ask for permission alike to do, to go to the washroom. Ask for permission, and the teacher had the option of saying no. How ridiculous is it if you think about it?
I've been told no. I actually have a teacher, and then I think a bunch of us complained.
Yeah.
And thankfully he was, I don't know if he was let go, I don't remember, but I know he didn't teach us after that unless he was teaching somebody else. He would actually, you know, teachers at that point were allowed to.
Sure.
You know, you could kind of do something
free with the ruler. The Yeah.
If we asked to go to the loo in the middle of class, we would get like one fun fact on the bum and then you would be sent. And I'm like, why? Like in hindsight, like why? What is the logic? And I think, I remember he did that to a girl student. And she told her parents and they came and complained. And this guy was, for him, it was like a thing, like, why are you disturbing the class? So it's like a small thing. But And I was like, what, fourth standard, fifth standard, something like that.
Think about the effect that would have had on a generation of students on free thinking and coming back to entrepreneurship, which would require free thinking, which would require out of the box thinking. This would probably train your mind to say, none of that. Let's just follow orders. Let's just go. Let's just get a fixed, stable job or a government job. There's a reason why most kids were encouraged to be doctors or engineers. That was the norm. Yeah. That is what would qualify as a good student.
And it's not just school, right? I remember my engineering college. So I still love to code before I got into engineering. I didn't get into engineering through merit. I was management quota, as they called it.
Sure.
Because I was terrible at physics and chem and maths, but I was good at coding. But if you want to do a BCA or a three-year degree versus a four-year degree, standard conversation. Okay, let's just try and get into this, right? But I got into mechanical. And my head of department sent me back home once. I was suspended for a day or two. So I wore a t-shirt which had said Howard, because my uncle lives in Boston. He'd come back and sometimes, you know, family gets you t-shirts. And he said, you can wear, because you're not allowed to wear printed t-shirts in college. This is engineering college. I'm not talking school. There was a senior of mine got suspended because he wore a Nike t-shirt, which had a tennis ball go through glass, breaking the glass. You are promoting violence or.
Of course.
And I still think back, I'm like, what do you get from doing that? I actually told that if you wear a Harvard t-shirt, when you go to Harvard, here you wear this college's t-shirt. And I'm like, and because of some of those things, and because I would ask them why, I know for a fact that I would not get, I was also a terrible student. So that's a fact, but you wouldn't be favorably marked, let's say, right? That would be a part of it. But I feel that I can breach this whole like, oh, people who are either conforming entirely and they seem to be getting it right, or people who in some form don't want to conform, want to ask a why, and they're suddenly relegated to that thing. So you would not even want to be in college. And I think now we're at an interesting point, because a lot of, like, I was talking to one of these, and I call him a kid because he's very young, who's wrote to me, he's one of the, follows me online. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want to be a creator. I don't want to study. But I don't know how to tell my parents. Do you think there's someone who can talk to my parents? I said, it's going to be between you and your parents. None of us can kind of come in and have that chat. It is going to be between. But I understand his struggle. Mm. I can understand what he's going through in his head. But it still comes down to, like, you can't take that responsibility, right? It'll have to be him and his parents, and he'll have to figure that out. But because I think there's a generation now seeing the option of an alternative.
Yeah.
But their parents are from a generation who don't understand that alternative yet.
Yeah.
And I feel that's where the struggle is.
So here is my conflict here, because when somebody goes down a traditional route, they are taught certain things. They are taught a sequence of, educational steps to take, which will qualify them for a particular job. Mm. It's a very industrial way of thinking, but you can understand why it has come around.
Yeah.
Now, in this world of startups and entrepreneurship, how do you even guide someone down that road if somebody says they want to do this?
Mm.
Since there is no course, there is no specific series of steps. How would you do it if somebody like this asks you advice?
I honestly just tell them what I would have done and what I might have done in the past, and I let them make their own decision. I realize that's the only way you can do it, is that tell them what your experience has been like. Give them an honest picture of what you believe will be the pros and cons of all sides.
Yeah.
Because to be honest, me getting a four-year degree was as much my decision as it was my parents. Because I'm like, okay, that's the only way you could actually go study in the US, for instance, right? Which is where I wanted to kind of go. We all want to do that standard trip, right?
Sure.
Here, go to the US.
Yep.
So at some point, you need to say, and a year here and there will not really affect your life. My one of my favorite tweets in recent times, which I quote very often, I still don't know who said it, but there was someone who said that, have you even done anything if you don't have one startup by the time you're 19? And someone replied saying, "Uske baad kya karoge?" Which is so true, right? Like, you're just 19, it's fine. And I feel at some point we also like overestimate the value of, okay, this 1 year, if I don't, what's going to happen? It's fine. I finished my 4-year engineering degree in 6 years. I loitered around, I did a lot of things and eventually got somewhere. You do get somewhere as long as you work towards learning stuff as it happens to you, right?
Yeah.
But I feel that the big struggle is going to be explaining what you're going to do and how. And I think parents are also right from their head that they just wanted to not struggle.
Yeah, they hedge for safety.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've also seen a change, right? So when I wanted to do, let's say, mass communication or I want to work in the media space, people didn't know.
Mm.
So my parents were fine. As they were reasonably fine because they kind of felt he's doing something which he seems to be really interested in. Yeah. Right, enough people around me who didn't understand. So when I'd say, okay, someone would make a joke about, you were so sad you were an engineer, now you are working for television. And I'm like, I'm not repairing TVs. Just like, and that's a fine job to have, but I'm actually doing this. And I've said producer, saying, why are you putting money into television? So people didn't know. Yeah. And I think I say worry, they thought a producer was someone who put money into TV shows. So I'm like, no, I'm actually managing it.
Yeah.
To now, like over the last like 5-6 years, I've had parents from back home, and I come from a place called Kakinada, coastal Andhra Pradesh,
mm-hmm.
And who get my number, call me up and say, okay, my kid wants to do this, something.
What's
in your space
here?
Can you talk to them about it? Can mm-hmm. you understand? Can they come and intern with you maybe? So it has not changed. I think people need someone to connect with. And I feel that for a lot of them, okay, this guy's done that. He seems to have succeeded. Maybe let's ask him. And my point was always this, is that this is what you can do. This is the pro, this is the con. And some of them have gotten into this and done a good job at it. But but you need to be able to open that up. And I feel that's what helps. The more people who try stuff out, the more normalized it gets. Like, I don't think people are really worried about anybody being a YouTuber today, because I think it's been normalized as a career option. People know you make money out of it.
Right.
How much money is a whole different conversation, but people make some money out of
it. Yeah, but that's true of all jobs, right?
Yeah.
In every job, there is a earn enough to just barely survive to make it big.
Yeah.
In today's world, what are, if I'm a young parent, what is that job that my kid might grow up to do that I don't even know about yet? And I can't even wrap my head around, but that might be the job 20 years later. Like, what's the future of entrepreneurship if you had to take a call?
I think so. The future of, I think, even jobs you're going to have. So I'm taking away deep technical, because I'm moving away from, like, let's say stuff around, let's say medicine, etc. Because I think that's always going to be there, right?
Yeah.
You're either going to be someone who is deep creative. You can be an innately creative person, and you will have, because the one thing we can't automate yet, and I don't think we will for a long time, is going to be creativity.
Mm.
You could just be a person who is something very, very like focused and specialized in the creative space, and you can have a very long career. So you could just be an artist, and I'm not going NFTs and crypto here, although that's where it's headed, but you could be an artist and make a lot of money out of it in life. But I feel what we don't know yet, and I feel what is interesting, especially in today's world, is that you could be anything and be a teacher around it, and that's how you might make money, which we don't give credit for. I feel that we're either entertaining or we are creating content to teach in an interesting way.
Everybody's a content creator, we're all in
a weird way. And people say, okay, while there's a struggle for actual teachers, I think the other side is this, that we're all inherently going to be teaching. Or we're going to be deep specializing in things which machines can't take over, because the more and more you see it, machines are taking over so much of the repetitive tasks there. But from a career standpoint, to be honest, it's my only thing is that don't go towards a career that can be automated, because at some point it will. Like, you know, just think of how many people are, when you still have lift men,
sure,
you still have people who, like, I'm looking at things like, example from my world, right? When you do advertising, you'd have like one master ad and you would make multiple versions of it. And then it was a human task.
Mm.
Now a large part of that is automated. You can automate it off a software where you can set some guardrails and it does it for you. So, and it does it far faster and in many ways more efficiently than a human would, because it's a repetitive task.
Yeah.
You find tasks that you can do by yourself, which is singular, which is focused, I feel that you'll have a very strong career. But on the entrepreneurship line, you are literally, your job might just be to kind of build the foundational elements of how newer businesses are built. It's very arbitrary when I'm saying it this way, but I feel that's where we're headed. We're headed towards saying, okay.
Like a meta universe where.
Yeah, everything's being disrupted, right? Like, I'm just thinking about just like last 2 years itself, the way we function inherently has changed. Is that one of the core things, and I remember reading about this, it's not a public story. I've read it in passing in a few articles, but one of the reasons why one of Spotify's first set of acquisitions, and I feel one of the companies they acquired had a software which helps you automate the process of making a podcast, which is basically what you need in a studio. You need something which two people walk in a software to be able to get both the mics in, level the audio, do all that stuff, export it in the right form. Normally you'd have people doing that, right? One of the companies, and I still haven't found an article. It's a credible one.
Anchor.
I don't think it was Anchor. So Anchor helps you upload and distribute.
Correct.
But this is the in-studio software.
Oh.
So Spotify, as they were doing it, this is something we inherently have as a backbone. Again, I've read it in random places. I haven't read it in a credible site, so I still don't know if it's true. But
Right. Because
they saw that in the future, they will have to kind of create so much content in like almost like an industrial form. Right. But what can you automate? You can automate the technical process. If someone walks in, like the mic I'm using right now comes with the software which auto regulates my level and all that stuff, right? So they got all of that in, and this is like 5-6 years ago. So it makes it easier for them to kind of create a lot more content, and they have all that there. So, but they can't create the actual podcaster. That is still a human being. So that's where it is. So for you to figure out what you will do in the future, think about either you're creating a way to automate things, or you're creating something that cannot be created by a machine. And that's the only two routes we'll take.
Wow. That's helping people. You can either create or you can help people create by automating some part of their creativity.
Yeah. I work in the production space, right? I work in the video production space, at least in terms of my role at The Glitch. And I have heard more conversation around technology and tech stacks and everything else in the last 2 years. And I have heard my entire career. I get asked more about, okay, automation software, so repurposing or building data banks of content. And somehow the other stuff still happening. It's not like we're still not shooting. We still have directors, still all that stuff. But the larger conversation is this, because you're seeing that this is scale. This is what everybody's doing, because every brand now has to create so much content. They realize no human being can do it. Let's bring technology into the mix, right? Can we do 100 pieces, 200 pieces, 1,000 pieces in a day?
Right.
Human beings can't do it. But who comes up with that main idea? Who comes up with that master creative? A human being will.
I feel like this is a whole Pandora's box waiting to explode. I think around the world, there must be 100 people who fully understand the potential of...
And they're the ones who capitalize on it, right? Like, for example, of an Indian company, this Pepper Content launched a tool called Pepper Type, which is an AI tool, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's helpful in making you come up with captions and articles. So let's say if I want to do something for Swiggy, I use their tool and I write out Swiggy. It's for the burger festival, write in burger. I put all the tags I'd want to give.
Yeah.
It will crawl the internet and see amongst these topics, what are people kind of talking about, and give me actual captions.
Wow.
That I can use as options, which I can tweak if I want to, but they largely do work as captions. So
wow.
What would need a bunch of people to sit and brainstorm and come up with captions? Now you have one or two people sitting. You have all these options. You tweak it to what you think might sound better. You're not fully just copy pasting, but you have suddenly reduced a 10 people job to a 1-2 person job. Yeah. And that tool for them, and they launched it early this year. It's been doing really well for them. And I remember seeing one of the first demos, and I'm like, okay, this is going to change stuff. This is going to inherently make things a lot more interesting.
It's essentially what conversations are doing is connecting neural networks across different data points. So your data points are different and mine are different.
Yeah. Yeah.
But your data points are also connected to something on the internet, something that you've read somewhere.
Yeah.
So technically, we can have a software do that as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Brilliant. I'm very excited. Maybe because I don't understand the downfalls of it, but I'm very excited. So about
which is why I think universal income is a conversation, right? And I feel governments see it. I feel governments see that eventually we aren't losing jobs from outsourcing. We are losing jobs from automating. And that will happen more and more. Like you talk about driverless cars. I'm like, what's going to happen to all the drivers?
Correct.
Right. Wow. And that's really the thing, which is why universal income. If you see every conversation around this, I think Bill Gates said this, right? He said that robots should be taxed. Mm. And this is why he said robots should be taxed. And that money is what will pay out universal basic income. And that's actually a fact. If every single car factory, every single unit that uses automation had us, we have so many cesses, this is another tax you kind of put on.
Yeah.
And that will pay for people to get social security in terms of basic income. And I feel that, I think that's the only answer.
Yeah, that makes sense because it has to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
Wow. This is the last part of what I wanted to talk to you about. This was an incredible conversation, Varun. I had questions written down and for a majority of the conversation, I didn't even look at it. It was just going on a free flow.
That's the best kind of podcast experience.
We briefly talked about crypto and NFT. So crypto, I kind of get the whole blockchain idea. Yeah. What is your take on NFT as a concept?
I'm still grappling with a lot of stuff around the crypto and NFT space, but I'm taking the artist part of NFTs out. That's easy enough to get, is the fact that there's digital art. Same way how everybody can have a Mona Lisa at home. It's just that, do you have the original Mona Lisa at home? Is just that. I think that's the only difference there. And I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
You will also have a lot of stuff come up as NFTs, which won't make any sense. And they will kind of go sideways. Right? You have everything becoming an NFT right now. But I feel what is interesting, and I think the example, weirdly enough, is if you look at something like two examples, right? One is the overtly complicated way in which Gary Vee is doing it, which I think is amazing, but he's just complicated a lot. So it's tough to understand.
Yeah.
But a simpler one, and I forget the band which did this. One of the bands released an NFT, and I forget the name of the band, which basically, if you buy the NFT, it gives you the ability to be in the front row of every one of their concerts for life.
Okay.
The NFT gives you that pass. It's almost like a pass for you to go. So tomorrow, if I don't want it anymore, I can sell it to somebody else. And every concert they do, this NFT gives me the ability to be front row for band I love.
Wow. Right.
So the other side of NFTs we don't talk about enough is how it's almost like membership cards, for lack of a better term, like loyalty points. But here it's transferable, right? Like I might have an NFT connected to my favorite artist, my favorite band. I have a creator whose NFT I buy, and let's say hypothetically, I say I give you 4 hours a year of one-on-one time. Ask me anything you want. I'm going to give you a catch-up physically. Going to get merch from me. And at some point, somebody might want to buy that off you.
Yeah.
And so when they buy that off you, they buy it off you at a premium, and the creator also gets a commission out of it, because that's how NFTs will work.
Yeah.
I feel that's the untapped source, but it's just that how many people will get there, how much value will it hold in the long term? It's a conversation for anybody, but
yeah,
I feel that part's going to be interesting for creators, is that it's about access. It's about what are you giving as value? In some cases, like Gary Vee's doing this for his conference, right? It's called the V conference. And everybody who has the NFT, I think gets in to the conference. And he's got the right idea there. He knows he's not an artist who's going to draw. I know he's drawing those weird characters. I feel what's interesting with what he's doing is that he's almost made it a pass. And I feel that many times that's the other way to do it, is that what if you have an NFT with your favorite author and you actually get to read the first draft?
Yeah.
Or it's access. I feel in many ways it is going to become access. It's going to be your that one gold card, platinum card kind of a scenario.
It's a next step of YouTube subscribers versus YouTube members.
Yeah,
so every channel can have memberships. Similarly, every community will have its own currency, which is their NFT.
Except here it's limited in supply and it can be transferred or sold to somebody else.
And the value will change.
The value will change because somebody else will eventually want to, let's say you had this for a, think about it this way. If there was an indie musician, and they release an NFT and I buy the NFT. they blow up, they become the biggest group, biggest yeah. artist in the world. Like imagine somebody yeah. had like a BTS NFT before BTS become BTS, and right. you buy that and it gives right. you access to be able to meet them once a year.
Incredible.
Imagine how much that person would make today.
Yeah.
From anybody who might want that opportunities, and they can quote the price and sell it for that. BTS makes money off it because inherently on NFTs, the creator also gets some cut. Amount of money.
Right.
But because you bought it early,
right.
It's again, it's like art, right? When again, I go back to the Mona Lisa example.
So how many can you mine? Or not mine, how many can you make?
Yeah, that depends on the creator, right? I mean, right. The lesser you make, the more value
valuable it is. It.
And that's why they do you can do multiple levels. I can do like, you know, say again, bronze, silver, gold, platinum.
That
I feel
is
that's
incredible.
The opportunity. That can just change the game, right? But again, it just depends on how you do it, how long you can consistently give that value. And I feel most creators are going to start looking at ways where a lot of the creation requires a singular human being to do all the work.
Yeah.
In the sense that, like, I do 2 podcasts. I have plans for 2 more.
Mm.
But I know that beyond 3 will be a stretch for me because it still needs me to be there for that 1 hour, 2 hours yeah. to record, right?
Yeah.
But can I do something that doesn't require me to be there all the time? And I feel a lot of creators will eventually, as they grow, move towards that. Which is why most creators are becoming entrepreneurs, right? You're starting businesses, you're finding different, you're doing other things to make money.
Yeah.
Or become actors and do everything else. And which is why the actor versus creator thing is that an actor doesn't have to create content all the time.
Mm.
You can do a movie, you can do a show, take a break.
Yeah.
And maybe put up photographs in Maldives. But I think that's the ability to kind of build these things at the back end will also kind of help most creators as well.
This is fascinating to me because as a doctor, we are tied down by both space and time.
Mm.
So for me to function, I have to be in a particular space yeah. Yeah. for that much amount of time to earn that much money.
Yeah.
So for me, content creation allows me to escape the space paradigm. I don't have to be in any particular space, but the time is yeah. still there.
Exactly.
So now I'm reaching a point where, oh, can you escape both space and time
yeah.
while
yeah.
still functioning?
Exactly.
Which is incredible.
Which is the break you need, right? Which again, it goes back to just like giving your mind that space to... So I do this thing constantly on all forms of content I put out, and I keep putting a thing, okay, I'm taking a pause. And that's my thing. I'm taking a pause. Like I wrote my newsletter, guys, because I have a book coming out next year. And I was like, I just submitted my final draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I just finished, I think, close to a year of my newsletter. My newsletter has been my feedback loop to write the book. I said, I'm taking the rest of the month off.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I said, just catch up on stuff you might not have finished reading because not everybody's reading or watching or listening to everything you put out every week.
Yeah.
And I think that I get a lot of like, and it's nice to see the reaction is very positive when you say that because we totally get it. I've done that on all my podcasts. Like, Advertising is Dead finished 100 episodes. I said, taking a month off. I haven't done that on the Varun Dubey show yet. I'm planning to, I've just crossed 50 episodes recently. I'm like, maybe I should do it. I'll wait for some more time. But I think that's, and almost build it into what people expect. People know you're going to take a break. Shouldn't expect you to put out everything all the time. You know, it's not the bottomless pit that needs feeding.
Yeah. Self-help, man. Yesterday was mental health day and all the conversations around this.
Yeah.
That you need to be aware. You need to know when you have to step back.
Exactly.
Thank you, man.
This is great. It's great. These are things I actually have started to enjoy talking about a lot more. So it's always fun to. I didn't realize till it hit an hour, and I'm like, I just turned around the clock, and I'm like, oh, it's been an hour. So I was like, yeah.
I'm very aware of. I wanted to try and finish it in an hour, but like I said,
that's good.
The conversation got away.
It was a great chat.
Thank you. Awesome. I'm gonna see you soon, man.
Bye.
See you.